This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, play boppet with language until the batteries run out. Coming up in today's show, a famous man who is colourfully dressed, has trademark facial hair, goes by many names. No, not Prince. I have to issue a content warning. Screen this episode before listening to it with young children, as there may be life spoilers. To warm up, here's some word history. Here is where we get the word clue. It descends from the Old English word clue, spelt C-L-E-W, which meant a ball of thread or yarn, and still has various rope-related meanings in nautical and theatrical terminology. But take a look at Greek mythology for a clue about how clues became clues. Theseus was given a clue by Ariadne so he could leave a trail of string to find his way back out of the labyrinth after he was done killing the Minotaur. You see, the clue led him to a particular result. Now, though in some places clue does still have the stringy meaning in spelling, as of the 1620s, the metaphorical sense became the dominant one, which is usually the kind of thing that makes me think, is this a made-up etymology? But in this case, no. On with the show. Dear Kathy and Mike, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. I hope you and the kids. Oh, what next? I can't think of anything to say to these people. Why am I sending them a card at all?
Just totally meaningless communication.
Look, I'm communicating with you. I'm just not actually communicating any meaning.
This card was really small before I opened it. Why is there so much blank space inside?
How do I sign off? From Helen. That's cold. Love from Helen. Yeah, way too strong. I don't even like them all that much.
XOXO.
That's not my style. Everyone would think it's a forgery.
Oh, great. 40 more to go.
And this is why, many years ago, I decided to stop sending Christmas cards, and I have never regretted it. However, though I'm not one to get nostalgic, especially for times before I was even alive, here's one case where I think things were better in a bygone era.
Some Victorian Christmas cards are utterly bonkers. My favourite one was a Christmas card that just had some bacon attached to it.
All right, now you're talking. I mean, that is Greg Jenner talking. Greg is the chief nerd at the BBC's Horrible Histories.
There's another one that had a dead mouse attached to the front.
Very festive.
Very nice. My favourite one, I think, is a policeman being attacked with a red-hot poker by a clown. Another lovely one is some children at the parents' funeral. Classic Christmas fare.
Good fun.
There's one being of two children being attacked by a giant wasp.
Are these all Victorian ones?
All Victorian Christmas cards. Christmas cards take off big styly in 1843.
Well, the post had just started in 1840.
Yes, hugely important. So until 1840, the postman would come 12 times a day and you paid on receipt. So they would turn up and they would bring you a letter and you would have to pay for it. And for every letter, you'd have to pay for the letter. And this was reformed in 1840 by Rowland Hill, and they changed the system and said, no, this is silly. You pay in advance and you'll pay with a stamp. And you stick it on the letter and you post it and off it goes. And so this meant that people would pay in advance for a letter and you didn't have to pay to receive letters. So people start sending millions and millions, and I mean literally millions of letters to each other. And in 1843, the first Christmas card is published by Henry Cole. And it's a nice illustration of people having a nice festival meal together. The Christmas card takes its influence really from the Valentine's Day cards. And if you study Christmas cards, as I have done, a lot of them have spring imagery, loads of flowers, loads and loads of illustrations of birds and plants and greenery. And the interesting thing is Christmas seems to have been a romantic period for young couples who are courting. So the mistletoe thing, that picks up. So mistletoe had been banned by most churches because it's pagan
and poisonous.
It's also poisonous, but the Vikings had used mistletoe. They'd kissed underneath it on the cheeks to seal pacts of peace between warring kings and stuff. And mistletoe then kind of gets co-opted into this romance idea of kissing under the mistletoe. And so Christmas cards take on this double Valentine idea that you send a Christmas card to someone you kind of fancy. And that's a thing called floriography.
Floriography is the language of flowers. It's an ancient language. Meaning has been ascribed to different flowers for millennia around the world. But in Britain, it blossomed in popularity in the Victorian era. Through flowers, Victorians could cryptically say, I love you, or I would, but I'm engaged to another, or sorry, friend zone, because the Victorians couldn't or wouldn't speak frankly.
Every flower has a meaning, and so you'd send a card to someone you fancy with a flower on the front, that would sort of have a hint, kind of saying, hey, I'm really into you. So it's a kind of time of courting and romance, but also it's a time in the 19th century of the British Empire of people being separated. Soldiers and expats are being sent off to India and Jamaica or wherever, you know, off to these faraway colonies. And so people are sending Christmas cards as a way of bringing the family back together through communication, through letters and posts and so forth. So Christmas cards have a really important role. They're kind of like a glue that keeps families together.
And during the same period, the Victorian era, one particular man started turning up ever more frequently on Christmas cards. Father Christmas, Santa Claus, St. Nicholas, Kris Kringle, Babbo Natale, Papai Noel, Pelsnickel, Ded Moroz. What do you call him, Greg Jenner?
I've always been a Father Christmas guy. Although when I was in France, so I'm half French, and we used to have alternate Christmases in Paris. And there, he's Père Noël.
Father Christmas,
Father
much.
Christmas, but weirdly French. Like, you know, you speak to him in English and he looks at you a bit funny and goes, quoi? which is one of the reasons at the age of 4, I decided there was no God and no Father Christmas. I was, because already too much didn't add up. This Father Christmas guy, he should be a polyglot. He should know all the languages.
Well, he needs to.
Yeah.
It's a really difficult job.
So that was problematic for me as a child. So yeah, he's Father Christmas to me. But he's an interesting character because he sort of means a lot to different people around the world, has different names, and they've come from different origins. So St. Nicholas, obviously, is a Christian saint, St. Nicholas of Myra, which is a place in Turkey.
There are a few St. Nicholases, aren't there?
Yeah, there are lots of St. Nicks, but the classic one is St. Nicholas of Myra, who was a bishop in 4th century, probably AD. And he is the patron saint of children, sailors and prostitutes.
St. Nicholas's feast day took place in December and was celebrated with gift-giving, so you can see what he has in common with the present-day poster boy for Christmas. We'll come back to St. Nicholas.
Meanwhile, in the pagan world, in the sort of Saxons and Viking era, the Saxons have got this guy, they call him Winter King or the Frost King, mm-hmm. sometimes Old Father Time. He's sort of a bearded bloke who turns up and gives you prezzies.
Why does he give you prezzies?
He's kind of a deity, mm-hmm. and he's kind of rewarding you, but also it's a tough time of year. There's not much food about and it's quite cold. So it's
just to cheer people up?
A bit, yeah. So the Saxon version of Christmas is called Hjaal, G-E-A-O-L.
Mm-hmm.
Winter is called Juli. And Hjaal, of course, in Viking is Jul, which is where we get the word Yule from, as in a Yule log. The Vikings, they believe in Odin, king of the gods,
mm-hmm.
and he supposedly flies around on his eight-legged horse, Sleipnir.
Eight-legged?
Yeah, eight legs.
Where'd they get that from?
Well, I guess it's quicker than four.
I don't know, it seems like they could get tangled up very easily.
I agree.
But it's more stable than
but
four,
he can fly,
maybe.
So maybe it's a sort of stability, aeronautical thing, I don't
All
know.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, he's a flying horse, and supposedly Odin delivers bread to people, and wears a sort of nice cloak, and so he's sort of a similar idea in the Viking tradition. So there's a kind of pagan version of this sort of Winter King with a beard who turns up at Christmas and says, hey, presents for everyone.
Okay, Winter King, Frost King, Odin, hard to see how they end up combined with a Christian saint, but stick with it.
As it sort of scrolls forward, Christianity re-enters the pagan lands, of course, of England and Norway and Germany and so forth. They kind of mush together a bit, but St. Nicholas still isn't really part of the picture, because instead he becomes called things like Sir Christmas.
So Sir Christmas.
In the Tudor times, he's Captain Christmas, one of the Avengers.
That sounds really fun.
Briefly, he's Captain Christmas. After Cromwell dies and you get the restoration of Charles II, he's referred to as Old Christmas. So he's like, oh, Old Christmas is back again. And he's a kind of genial bloke who turns up and everyone gets hammered and has a big old feast.
Right.
So there's a fairly innocuous non-Christian element to it. I mean, these are Christian people, but there's a sort of secular tradition of just Old Father Time, a bearded bloke who turns up at the end of the year. It's kind of pagan. Yeah. And then what happens is the Dutch get hold of him, and the Dutch call St. Nicholas Sinterklaas. And Sinterklaas then gets carried across to America by the Dutch, because the Dutch obviously are Protestants and they go to America, and they bring him with them, and Sinterklaas turns into Santa Claus, and Santa Claus becomes Santa Claus. And Santa Claus is effectively Father Christmas, but he's a kind of Christian version rather than the pagan version that we've got in England.
There we go. As with the occasion of Christmas itself, Christian and pagan traditions combine into an amalgam which, frankly, seems odder and odder the more you scrutinise it.
So ours is Father Christmas, and he's kind of a bearded bloke who brings you stuff. Whereas Sinterklaas is much more religiously themed. He's much more of this sort of St. Nicholas idea.
Until he goes to America.
Yeah, and then in America, and in Britain as well, in the 19th century, he starts to be a stand-in for Jesus. So he takes on a moral element. He's a way of communicating to kids the idea that if you're good, you get rewarded. Now, of course, it's very hard to explain that to a child, that if you're good in life, you go to heaven. Because kids are like...
That's ages away. Yeah. Irrelevant.
I'm four.
Reward me now.
I want biscuits. I want a PlayStation. So they developed this idea that Father Christmas is kind of this Christ allegory who says, okay, kids, be good and you'll get a prezi. So he takes on this moral element. He becomes a kind of backup Jesus. And so that's when he starts being much more of a religious figure. And that's when you start seeing the kind of the church starting to embrace him, and he becomes more of a part of the kind of Christian Dickensian Christmas that we know of now.
So you've got these kind of wild men and then these saints and this bearded grandfatherly figure all being rolled into one Father Christmas.
And being given a sort of didactic purpose, which is to make kids love Christianity and be sort of good moral people. And then,
or at least materialistic monsters.
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that then capitalism takes off, and so you then start getting in the late 19th century, Father Christmas will start showing up in department stores, and that's when you start getting the kids queuing up to meet Santa, when commercialism really captures Christmas as an idea.
And we can rail against it, or we can accept it as part of the continuing evolution of Christmas.
But this is the process of history. The really interesting thing for me as a historian is the way in which tradition gets invented, and every generation invents new traditions and then tells their kids, oh, this is a tradition that's been really old for ages and you must follow it. So I think every generation probably takes what it wants from the past and then throws away the stuff it doesn't want, and then it adds its own bit, and that's kind of the joy of Christmas, I think.
Greg Jenner's book, A Million Years in a Day, is out now in paper, e, and audio forms, and it's pretty much the perfect book for you illusionist listeners. There are loads of linguistic facts. It's full of the history of everyday things like toilets and beds and why time is measured the way it is. And it's funny, I'll even forgive the puns, that's how good the book is. I'll link to it at theillusionist.org/Christmas. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is afferent. Physiology, adjective, relating to or denoting the conduction of nerve impulses or blood inwards or towards something. The opposite of efferent. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. Martin Austrick did the music. Thanks very much to Julie Shapiro. You can find the show at theallusionist.org and as Allusionist Show on Facebook and Twitter. It's always very interesting to see your responses to each episode, and I've been delighted to discover that since the last one, lots of you have been learning Tokipona, and you seem to be a lot more capable of grasping it than I am. Some of you have also been wondering whether Tokipona is analogous to Newspeak in George Orwell's 1984. I think, as Sonia Lang didn't invent Tokipona to replace all other language, it's too benevolent to be like Newspeak. Though it does rather depend on what you lot decide to do with it, doesn't it? I'm hoping you'll err on the side of utopia rather than dystopia. I think that's probably always the smart thing to do. Unless writing popular fiction for teenagers. Anyway, the show will be back in a fortnight.